And I need to make sure everybody knows that you're listening to WNTD Avenue 950 here in Chicago. The phone number is 312-329-0950. And also, I want to make sure that everyone is aware there is a concert coming up this Friday. James Sanders and Conjunto will be performing at the Velvet Lounge, which is 67 East Cermak Road, October 30th, this Friday, at 9 p.m. Now, if you're not familiar with James and Conjunto, Conjunto is one of the hottest jazz groups, Latin jazz groups, in Chicago. James performs. He plays violin. They have conga, bass, drums, piano, everything. It is really grooving. And they're going to be performing at the Velvet Lounge this Friday night, October 30th at 9 p.m. This is a great opportunity to see Conjunto in an intimate atmosphere. They play a lot of festivals. So why don't you join James Sanders and Conjunto at the Velvet Lounge this Friday, October 30th, starting at 9 p.m. For more information, you can visit ChicagoLatinJazz.com. That's www.ChicagoLatinJazz.com. Okay, we are back, and as we've been discussing, we've been on the Paul Wertico watch here while Christine went over to pick him up at the concert, and he is here. So we're happy to have Paul here in the studio. How are you, Paul?
Great, Mike. I'm flying high right now because we just had an amazing concert over at Chicago College of Performing Arts, because our combo program is genre-specific. So tonight we had a bebop combo and the avant-garde combo. And they sound like pros. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, they sound like you would go pay to go hear these kids. And some of them are only like sophomores and stuff, you know. Some of them are freshmen. Yeah, it's really
well. Let's talk a little bit about that since we're on that subject. You know, as I mentioned before, as a setup when we were talking about who was going to be on the show tonight, I mentioned Paul was coming in the studio. You just got back from playing in Ireland. You flew in yesterday and did all this stuff, and. You're at Roosevelt University as the is it the jazz studies?
Yeah, it's Roosevelt University and the conservatory, the music conservatory, and theater conservatory is under the it's the conservatory's name is Chicago College of Performing Arts.
Okay.
So I'm head of jazz, and now we've changed it. We've updated. I'm head of jazz and contemporary music studies there.
Oh.
Which is a trip for me. You know, it's fantastic.
Now, have you ever run a department before? I know you've been teaching forever and doing lots of stuff, but I never even knew you had any time to do something like
this.
Well,
you know, you know, I've been on the road all those years.
Yeah,
you know, I've run away from departments, but you know, and it was just one of those things where I was teaching drums there. I was asked to teach drums there, and I really liked the school. And just one day, I went in and. Linda Berner, the dean, assistant dean there, you know, I just went in and I just said, well, you know, if there's anything else you want me to do or something. And then the next thing I know, they were, you know, asking me if I wanted to teach there full time. And I was like, wow, because I never even really thought about doing that.
Right.
Because I'd just been a road rat my whole life, basically. And, you know, I didn't even accept it at first. I thought really hard because I wanted to make sure that it was something that it, not only did I want to do, but that I thought I could do. And it's just, I'm having a time of my life because, you know, it's really investing in the future. It's really, and you know, it's great to play. I mean, coming back from Ireland, I just played the Guinness Cork Jazz Festival, and that was totally great. And I played with Dominique DiPiazza, who was the bass player with John McLaughlin, Zakir Hussain, and great Irish guitar player Mike Nielsen. And it was wonderful to play. But then I come home, and it's just as wonderful to teach, you know. And then when I hear my students sound that good, it's like, I'm as proud of them as I would be of anything I would have done.
You know, the thing that I think is really great for students, too, having you there would be, you know, obviously you've played so many different styles. And that's the thing that I think that a lot of people have to realize. You know, when you're going to music school and you go to a quote-unquote jazz department, there's millions of versions of jazz. I mean, we're going to talk about all the different things you have happening. Mm-hmm. At the school. So to have somebody like you who's played in all these different genres, and I mean not just like, you know, faked here, faked there, and you know, okay, yeah, I play bebop, I play Latin jazz, but you actually nail the styles.
Thank you.
To be able to have somebody come in, and I know you and I have talked about all this stuff before, and why don't we talk about it now so that people understand, you've got different ensembles for different genres of jazz. And the kids actually have to nail that. And that's what you're talking about with the bebop and the avant-garde.
Right. Because, you know, most combo programs in colleges, you know, they have a big band or two, and then they have some combos. And a lot of times the combos are just based on, like, the level of the student. So, you know, you have your beginner combo and your, you know, up to your advanced combo. And I always thought that was a horrible idea because it's not real world. I mean, you know, I mean, when you play, a lot of times the best way to get better is to go up and play with really good players, you know, older guys and guys with experience. And if they take you under their wing, then they raise you up as opposed to, like, if everyone's at the same level, they're all swimming around, no one can really help each other. And plus, you know, just like even coming back from this festival in Ireland, I mean, there's all kind of jazz, and it's all usually progressive and different things, but you know, yeah, you're right. I've been around. I've seen all this stuff. So I really wanted to put a program together that I thought would be comprehensive in giving a background to the kids, but I also thought would be real-world applicable, you know? And so right now we have a swing combo, which, I mean, you would think, okay, that's the easiest stuff, but that's, in a lot of ways, that's most difficult in some ways. And a lot of times the kids, the better kids, even want to be in the swing combo now.
Like the swing combo is like what?
It would be, you know, it would be the really early stuff. So it would be, you know, Fats Waller, you know, Benny Goodman, you know, pre-bebop.
Yeah.
And then we have a bebop combo, you know, which just speaks for itself. And then a hard bop combo, which does sort of hard bop and, you know, sort of slash, you know, cool jazz around that, you know, that 50s period, early 60s period. Then we have an ECM, you know, combo named after ECM Records, which is sort of that chamber jazz kind of thing, you know, the Gary Burton-ish, Keith Jarrett stuff. We have a fusion combo that plays, you know, Ma Vishnu and Weather Report kind of stuff. We have the free jazz avant-garde combo that I run. It goes everything from playing like Ornette and Albert Ayler, but also like today they just improvised. I mean, everything they did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was almost, it wasn't like free jazz. It was almost like, you know, like Pink Floyd or something sometimes. I mean, they're reading out of books, you know, and making up these. I mean, it was really cool. And then we have a Brazilian combo, because, you know, which is fantastic, taught by a label mate, Paulino Garcia. And then contemporary combo, which is taught by John Mulder. And that's the newest, you know, that's, you know, sort of Kurt Rosenwinkel, polytonal, polymeter, poly, you know, chordal, everything kind of tunes. And so the kids, they just jump right in there. And so, you know, even our auditions for combos are almost meaningless now. I mean, it's more for the jazz orchestra, because they're going to rotate anyway. And so that way, if you know, almost all our kids play great now. But, you know, if you have one or two that are having trouble, they have to rise to the occasion, and they do, you know. And it's really amazing.
Well, I think that you know, by having all these different combos, and I mean, I went to music school, and it was always kind of, you had to learn all these styles, but the school didn't necessarily give you the ensembles to work on them. So it was like, you know, I mean, I went to North Texas, and it was, you were swinging, you were playing jazz, you were doing stuff, but if you wanted to play a fusion thing, you got to start your own thing, because there wasn't an ensemble. If you want to do ECM style stuff, you just do it on the side, because you're playing bebop stuff in the combos. How many other colleges actually do it this way, or is this?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I can't say for sure one way or the other, but, you know, none around here that I know of. I mean, and I'm not saying that's in
good
a
bad or bad
way. Yeah, I'm just saying that nobody else is doing it that way. And at first, you know, I met some resistance. I mean, a few, when I proposed it a long time ago, a few of the faculty members that now like it were like, well, that's not going to really work or whatever. But not only did I know it was going to work. I just knew it. You know, it was sort of like this record, you know, the new record, I knew it was going to work. You know, you just know after a while.
Right.
And
we're going to talk about
it. And
the other
thing that's cool about it is that some teachers are just, they're just better, or they're more knowledgeable in certain areas. You know, somebody might be better at sort of an ECM thing than a bebop. So if you just have beginner to advanced combos, and they're every semester they're playing, you know, Blue Bossa and Giant stuff. I mean, you can go through eight semesters of that. And what have you really gotten into? You never really got into the thing. Plus, not all the teachers are that familiar. I mean, when we have a Brazilian combo, it's taught by Paulino Garcia, who's Brazilian. So, you know, it's not just playing Girl from Ipanema, you know?
Right.
And so that's the thing, too, is to really give a comprehensive, like, hit on each semester. And then, for instance, I teach my students. We usually, you know, we work on other things, but we usually try to focus on what the combo they're working in. And that way it gives some context, you know, to the technical things that we're working on, too. It's not just, you know, just, well, I'll do these pages. And then, you know, they're going, well, what am I going to do with this? They can utilize it, you know, an hour later when they're rehearsing.
It makes perfect sense.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean,
it does.
Geez, who would have thought a drummer made perfect sense?
I know. Certainly not this one. Maybe you, but not me. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, obviously Paul's been all over the world and back with millions of different musicians performing all over the place. But before we get into all the history and everything, I know that you have this new recording out on Chicago Sessions label. And why don't we talk a little bit about how this record came about?
Okay.
I mean,
it's a story.
We played a tune. What did we play? We played First Circle.
Oh, did
so
you?
So people heard heard that. And we played a little bit of the very early of the
Silvano, and Mark Egan.
Yeah. So there's, you know, straight ahead stuff. There's what would you call the Matheny? Is that like fusion stuff?
I don't know. You know, it's just the trouble is that, like, trying to label anything and talk about having to play a lot of different musics. I mean, you know, one set of Matheny's music, you know, we would swing, we would rock, you know, it'd be classical, it'd be a march. I mean, it's just a hybrid of things, and, you know, just it's Pat's music, Pat and Lyle's music, you know, the way they write.
Right. Well, and then like talking about the new album, which is Mid East and West Alliance.
No, it's Mid East Midwest Alliance.
I thought I read that, but I read it wrong.
Oh, that's okay.
Now this is what would you call this? Because it's not necessarily a style of music, but what?
Well,
conceptually, what are you doing? Because it's hard to classify.
Well, I mean I'm glad. You know, I don't want it to sound like anything else. And actually, you know, I don't think it sounds like anything else. That's what's so cool about it. And the concept, I mean, to make a long story long, what happened was, I teach drums sometimes at home, and so I got this call out of the blue from this guitar player, Danny Rabin, who had just moved here with the sax player, Danny Markowitz. They had moved here from Boston, and Danny Rabin said, oh, you know, the percussionist, Jamie Haddad, that they used to work, you know, study with in Boston. So, oh, you should look at Paul when you're here. So I said, okay, fine. I said, but I teach drums. They go, oh, no, it's okay. We just want to just hear us
over
comment.
And,
yeah. So, you know, I kind of wrote down, you know, time for them to come over a couple days later. And then I forgot all about it. You know, so I'm having dinner with my family. All of a sudden the doorbell rings and it's like, oh, no. And then I look out there and it's these two guys and they got amplifiers and tons of pedals. And I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. You know, so I said, okay, just go set up. I'm going to go finish my dinner. So I'm expecting the worst, you
right,
know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they start playing and it sounded like an ECM record. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And so immediately, you know, like my brain started going, wow, this would be the two missing guys in my trio. This would be make it into a quintet. So as luck would have it, my daughter was having a bat mitzvah like 2 weeks later, and my wife had hired Brian Peters and John Mulder, who were in my trio, to play just, you know, after the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we hired the two Dannys, and they played together, the four of them, and it was just, and I couldn't play. I was, you know.
Right, you were.
I'm doing my thing. So, you know, I'm going, oh, I can't wait to play with these guys. So at the same time, you know, Nick had started sounding me. He came, I think, in December to a Larry Coryell gig at the Showcase and wanted me to do on the label. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, we just didn't really take it any further than that. But then I started getting this idea, like, yes, this would be the thing to do. And Nick, who I didn't really know, that I know him now, he's like the greatest label, you know, guy, because I mean, he just gave me carte blanche, because I said, man, we're just going to go in, we're going to play, we're not going to meet, we're not going to rehearse. The first time we play together is going to be in the studio. And that's basically what we did. We just set up mics and we just went for it.
Do you talk through concepts or
no,
anything, or you just start playing?
Nothing. I mean, you know, maybe later on, you know, like if I felt that, like, you know, I'd like to have this kind of mood or this, I mean, I might have suggested that, but it was just playing. I mean, even in Ireland with Dominique and Mike, we played two sets. We were the only one that got a standing ovation, you know, that night, and we didn't talk over anything. We just went up and played two sets.
Really?
Just on the fly.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, that's that's what we did. And with these guys, with the two Dannys and John Mulder and Brian Peters, I mean, the chemistry was just instantaneous. And it was just weird miracles happening. I mean, John Mulder played a fretless guitar for the first time ever, perfectly in tune. Yeah, he had never played. Danny Rabin has, like, because, you know, there's a lot of effects going on, and Danny likes to do this thing where he puts, like, a metal container, and he puts marbles in it, puts it on the guitar strings. So he didn't have any marbles with him. So we were recording at Studio Media in Evanston, and I went, oh, my God, right next door is you know, there's a craft shop. You know, so we, and it was like 5 to 6 and they closed at 6. We ran over there. They said, you have any marbles? The girl goes, yeah, there's some over there. And there's like a whole wall of marbles.
Probably,
you know?
Thought you lost your marbles, right?
I'm telling you, you know, it was like everything. It was like Zen archery, the whole thing. And really, we had much more material than we could ever possibly use. We could have probably had 3 CDs out of this. And even to cut it down to 63 minutes was excruciatingly painful because, you know, we didn't want to make things out of nothing because everything that's there is real. So, but we had to shorten things. So, you know, you cut out like the middle section or something of a
mm-hmm.
tune, and it's great. But, you know, I wanted the record to flow, because when you're playing this kind of challenging music where there's no melody necessarily, you know, you want people, you have to know when they're going to get tired. And plus, as the record goes on, you know, I didn't want the same length of tunes, because then, you know, they might get tired of hearing a 7-minute piece at the end. So then the other thing was to think about, okay, now I've got this stuff. the name, you know, because some people, you know, Brian said, I'll just call it Wertico, like, you know, stereonucleosis was just named Wertico. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, like, no, this, you know, there's two guys from Israel and there's three guys from the Midwest. I thought, let's just call it Paul Wertico's Mid-East Midwest Alliance. And then with the title of the record, Impressions of a City, I was just going downtown one time, and, you know, I started hearing all these sounds and reminded me of the music. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be a great idea, is to have, like, this concept of, like, it's just a day in the city. So the record basically starts out with, like, the dawn coming up, and at the end just goes, you know, at the end of the day. So then coming up with just funny titles, and I would just write down anything that came in my head on the train or whatever. I'd just write down stuff. And that was basically it. And then Nick had never done a cover art before. Nick Eifer's here.
Well, I've done a lot of cover art before, but not for your own label. Quite like that.
Oh, well, okay. Well, you know, and then so he came up with this thing. I think he was worried that I wasn't going to like it. And, I loved it. And my wife, this is fantastic. And I've gotten more compliments on
it. It was different from the other covers
in your series.
In the same way that this disc is different than the other discs.
Right.
And I knew the cover had to reflect the disc. The other covers have just instruments on them, and as we discussed, a drum set on the cover was not going to reflect what this album was about.
Absolutely not. And I still, you know, I listen to this thing all the time in the car, and I still hear new things. It's really wild. I mean, there's so many layers of sounds, and just depending on your stereo or where you're, you know, where you are in the room, certain sonic frequencies will come out, and you'll hear different combinations of colors, of mm-hmm. sounds, which is really great.
So you think, I mean, because I want to hear a track off of this, and
one track won't be representative of anything.
No.
There's 18 tracks, and they all have their sort of their own identity and flow into the next one. But,
well, you know, because I always want to talk to somebody about this. You know, you hear the avant-garde, the free jazz stuff, and everything like that, and Rich Corpulongo, who I know you probably
right,
know,
sure.
he calls it spontaneous composition.
Well, that was my, I came
oh,
up
that
with
was that, you, okay.
I came up with that name for the band.
I thought, oh, that's right, yeah, because you guys, that was like the best way to actually describe this kind of music, you know, because you always hear, oh, free jazz, is spontaneous composition, because that's what's happening.
Yeah. Well, and this too, this, I don't know how to say this, I mean, I teach a jazz history course at Roosevelt too. And talking about, like, Duke Ellington, I mean, his music was always had something to do with imagery. And Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue had the sounds of the city. So, I mean, there's a lot of history in this music, too. It's not just, like, free music. I mean, it's got elements of everything that we are, which is, the Mideast Midwest Alliance. I mean, there's, like, Mideastern reflections in here. There's, you know, rock, there's jazz, there's avant-garde, there's, like, classical, there's East Indian. And just the way the whole thing hangs together, it's like Duke Ellington used to write specifically for, you know, his musicians. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, his orchestra wouldn't sound the same just played by anybody else.
Right.
So this music is these five musicians playing together. That's what makes it special. And the combination, you know, was just, I just knew it. I mean, it was like one of those things where, you know, I wasn't worried. I wasn't thinking, oh, gosh, if nothing happens, what are we going to do? Because we only had two nights to record, because that's the way Chicago Sessions does it. You go in and you hit, and you get what you got, you know.
Right.
And which is great. I mean, that's the closest thing to the real thing, you know. And that's so we were, you know, and we had never played together before.
That's unbelievable.
And the Dannys told me later that they were so nervous when they were setting up because they were going to be playing with
me. Well, sure, because they ruined your session, now they just ruined Paul Wertico's
session. You know?
On his new label.
But, you know, I made sure, man, we had, I mean, we, you know, a lot of times you break and you have food. I mean, I made sure we ate first. So, you know, we had pizza and wine or whatever we had. So, you know, everyone settled. And then we played. And we was just, you know, got down to business after just hanging out and talking and kind of, you know, camaraderie.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think, a lot of ways why it was like this. And then Nick just stayed out of the way. I mean, you know, good engineers, they stay out of the way because that's their job, is to capture what's going on, you know, mm-hmm. not get in the way and say, oh, can you play a little softer or louder or whatever.
Right.
Or the worst one is like, whoops, I didn't have the button on. Can we try that again?
You know? That was really good. Could you do it exactly the same?
Right. So,
well, what are we going to hear? Let's play a tune.
I mean,
it's not going to be indicative of the entire album, but at least people can kind of get an idea of what it sounds
like. Well, okay. Like track 7. I mean, can I run off the titles here? Okay. The first tune is A Light Too Soon, which is like, you know, waking up, It's like, oh gosh, you know. And the second one is like, what should I wear today? Third one's bumper to bumper. Fourth is late again. Five, beauty wherever you can find it. Six, the boss needs to see you. Seven, 15 minutes for lunch. You know, people are just running around. So I think we're going to play 15 minutes for lunch because it just has that sort of feeling of like trying to eat on the fly.
Yeah.
And then number eight is I probably shouldn't have done that, which is probably a good idea. 15 minutes for lunch is not a good idea. The inside track, which sounds just like the train. You know, it sounds just like when I'm on the, you know, the Purple Line.
Mm-hmm.
A chance to breathe. Lake fish flowers, which is just, I said something in the car with my wife and daughter. I said lake fish flowers. They thought that was the funniest thing ever. My side of the story, which is the drum solo, word salad, closing the deal, drive at five, reflections on the day, I think I'm hungry, and good night and good luck. So
that's
so
a full day.
It's a full day, yeah. And good night and good luck is really, it pretty much closes out the record. After that,
yeah,
you're done, you know. So let's do, yeah, 15 minutes for lunch.
Okay, let's hear it. Well, that definitely sounded like 15 minutes for lunch. That was,
I love that.
That was cool.
Thank you.
Oh, man, it sounds like that old that Eric Dolphy album cover, Out to Lunch, that has the clock with about 13 different hands in every direction, man.
Great,
that's
record.
It.
You know,
and this sax player, he's going to Roosevelt. I mean, he's a student at Chicago College of Performing Arts. He's like, I think he's like 24 or something like that, 23, 24. Because he was in the Israeli army, you know.
Oh, wow.
And he hadn't played for a long time. Then he picked up the horn again. But he's in the avant-garde combo that played tonight, too. And he's just amazing. I mean, both him and Danny, their use of not only, you know, the way they play their actual instruments, but their use of electronics is really amazing.
I mean,
they have this stuff under control. It's really, it's
well, you know, so, I mean, like that, to me, and I, of course, I've heard the whole album a couple times, but that to me, just taken out of context, still works.
Oh, thank
but
you.
I can imagine if it's put in with if you listen to the entire album, there's lots of, I can't even get into how many different colors are in this entire album. I mean, it's like, but it's not like crazy stuff. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, you know.
You know,
it's got different emotions, you know. But the thing is, too, is also, like, a lot of times I tell people, you know, try to listen to the whole thing, too, you know. I mean, you don't have to. But I also say, like, you know, listen to it a dozen times before even judging it.
Right.
Because it's really different. But, you know, again, it's a matter of trust. You know, you trust the musicians and you just trust, you know, being open. I mean, that's how you keep growing as a listener and as a musician, is just, you know, you listen to things. And sometimes things will sound foreign to you and they can be threatening because they get you outside your comfort zone. But then you grow, you know.
Well, you know, sticking on that point, and I think a lot of our listeners are going to be curious about this, just as a drummer, you know, because you hear piano players, and you hear guitar players, and you hear everything being creative, quote unquote, right? But a drummer, he's just keeping time back there. What is going on? But when I listen to you play, and you know, there's a handful of drummers that are the time's there, but it's not being pounded out. It's being musically. It's being used musically within the group. So how do you, I mean, because you're playing all these different styles, and even getting away from this recording, just on all the other recordings you've done, how do you just approach something? Like when you get into a studio situation, and maybe you're in a studio with guys that you do know, guys that you don't know, how do you sit down and approach, okay, you know what, we're going to play this standard, or we're going to play this tune. How do I want to attack this?
You don't think about it beforehand. You start playing and listening. Mm-hmm. That's why I try to tell my students that, too, is because if you go in, you know, with malice aforethought, you know, you know, you're already locking yourself into something. So then if somebody plays something unexpected, you know, it's easy to kind of, like, get thrown. But if you just start playing, you just listen. I mean, a lot of times I say I don't warm up before I play, because I don't want to feel like, oh, geez, I'm tired. You know, I hope I have a good night because I'm a little stiff today or whatever. No, you know, I just sit down and music starts playing, and before I know it, I'm gone. You know, I'm into the music. So to me, it's like a conversation. And I just told this to a student today, actually. We were talking about what happens when people don't listen, or like when they're hung up on themselves. It's almost like, you know, when you're having a conversation with someone and while they're talking to you, you're thinking of the next thing you're going to say, so you have no idea really what they talked about. That's what happens to a lot of musicians. They're so worried about what they're playing that, in effect, they don't know what's going on around them. Now, that could be because they haven't mastered their, you know, instrument yet, so they're struggling, or it could be that they're just trying to be clever or trying to be brilliant all the time or whatever. But you just fall into the music. You know, you just become one with the music, and the music takes you away. And so that's the best way. And then the other thing, too, you know, is, you know, to have good time is important, to have phrasing, everything, but also to be conscious of form. I mean, if you can make form out of things that are even abstract, then you can build on those forms. So, you know, you do something, you remember what you played, and you're actually building something to build off of rather than just kind of playing. And so if you play a beat, it just kind of goes, and that's fine, you're keeping time. But if you're really constructing, you're basically, spontaneous composition, you're composing a part. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a big part of doing it. And it really helps to have good pitch. So, you know, like, if you can hear, I mean, like, for me it sounds weird, but I hear, like, two notes and I know the song already. You know, it's bizarre.
Right. Yeah.
So my brain just works that way. And so that also helps, too. So rather than just think about the drums, you're always thinking about the music.
How much do you think all of your experiences, like playing with everybody or listening to all of these different styles, has built up your playing? You know what saying?
Sort of.
I mean, because, you know, you could not listen to a lot of stuff and still play the drums. But I think that your concept expands the more stuff you're exposed to.
Absolutely. I mean, you are what you can and can't play. You are what you listen to and don't listen to. So for me, for instance, you know, as a kid, I just bought records voraciously. I mean, I listened to rock, jazz, Cuban music, you know, music from Chile, Tibetan monks, everything. Mm-hmm. So nothing, you know, Charles Ives. So nothing sounds weird to me. It just sounds like sound. And so when you're able to do that, then you don't judge it, and then you're able to react a little bit more purely. Plus, if you do listen to the styles of those musics, then you know the style again. So, you know, if you do play bebop, after listening to bebop, you understand what that's about.
Right.
Whereas if you don't listen to bebop and you just listen to country western and someone says, we're going to play a jazz tune, yeah, you're probably just going to go ding-ching-a-ding-ching-a-ding,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because you're going to be, you know, you're not going to understand the inner workings of it. So listening is really important. And that's what's so sad now. I mean, you know, it's great with YouTube and great, you know, that so much stuff's available on CDs, but, you know, there's no exposure to music to so many people. When I was in Ireland, they had the Jules Holland show. I remember, if you know Jules Holland,
mm-hmm.
keyboard player, I think he was with Squeeze or whatever. And mm-hmm. they used to have the show with Dave Sanborn, Michelob Sunday
okay,
night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I just had this show on. All of a sudden here, they had the White Stripes interviewing them, and they had a new band. Then they had this amazing band from Africa. Then they had Smokey Robinson with Eric Clapton just sitting in as a session player. And they just went from band and with interviews. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah.
And just, you know, we don't have anything like that anymore. I mean, just exposing these musicians and this music and all those different types in this really entertaining setting instead of all this reality stuff, you know, it's not even reality
mm-hmm.
that we have. It's junk, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's you know, it's interesting that you said that. So they have that over in Ireland, just down.
Well, yeah, that's from England, you know, because
right,
it's
right,
from
okay.
London. But yeah, you know, so many countries, you know, you go, Poland or Ireland or you know Italy or Brazil, they have music programs on all the time, concerts on all the time.
Wow.
It's just yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. And then here we have nothing anymore. I can't figure it out.
No, there isn't hardly anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been in the scene for a long time. Have you noticed dwindling crowds and different things like that, or you're kind of?
I mean, no. I think the crowds. I mean, obviously the economic situation affects things. So I think every festivals, you know, probably all down 10%. You know, it's entertainment
right.
Is last on the list sometimes when people are really hurting for money, but. Every time I think, well, you know, we're losing the kids and they're not getting it, then I get like Nick over here, you know, and I have got like all these guys that you know.
Nick, that's Nick the intern, by the way.
Nick Hagstrom over here is one of my students. You got kids that were just reminds me of me, you know, when I was younger, and
yeah.
they want it and they're talented, and you know, you just hope that they have the chance to do all the stuff that, you know.
Did you
play around the world
when you were growing up? I mean, it was probably you were probably exposed to a lot of music. Did you have one of those parents that listened to tons of music, or did
Not
you just
really.
Kind of
I
find
mean,
it on your
I
own?
I always like to say there was no musicians in the family, and I'm trying to uphold that tradition. But I'm opening myself up for a bad one there. But no, I mean, my mom, you know, sometimes would play Sarah Vaughan or stuff. But no, I mean. No.
No?
No. Basically, I don't know where I came from. I just dropped out of
school. You just started playing drums? Is that was your first instrument? Or?
Well, yeah. It was one of those things where we moved to Cary, Illinois from the south side, you know, suburbs when I was in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. My parents said, you should take up an instrument now. You know, we've moved here. And just don't take up the drums. And, of course, that's the only thing I wanted to take
that's
up.
That's the first thing
and
you
then
take
I joined
up,
the
then.
School band, you know, and I It was strange because, I mean, I could play the drums. I mean, I sat down. I didn't have a kit until I graduated eighth grade, but I could sit down in my friend's set, and I could play all this stuff.
Hmm.
And I could do one-handed rolls and all
really?
These things. Yeah, and people were going like, how do you do all this? And I go, I don't know. You know, it was just weird. And then, you know, because I was into chemistry, and I thought, oh, geez, you know, musicians, you know, get to sleep late, and they get all the girls and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that was the attraction.
Is that true, Paul?
Well, no, you know. But so the next thing I know, I had like a music scholarship, and it's just one thing led to another.
Yeah. Where'd you go to college?
Well, I went to Western Illinois, and that was another thing too, because I was the featured. Our high school band went around for about a week and played these different high schools, and I was sort of the featured soloist. And then like the last stop is at Western Illinois, and then I got a full scholarship there. So you know, I had my own car, my own apartment.
Oh wow!
I had made. I was in the playing timpani in the symphonic wind ensemble. I was in the top jazz band. But I also had a girlfriend that I would drive home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like a 5-hour drive each way. So, and then Cannonball Adderley came in during my second quarter and did a clinic. So it was Walter Booker and George Duke and Roy McCurdy, And they were playing it, and like everybody played, even my instructor. But I didn't really, I don't know, I didn't want to play. And then the last tune, my friend, you know, elbowed me, said, "Go up and play, go up and play." So I went up and took the sticks mid-tune out of Roy McCurdy's hands, and the place went up for grabs. And you know, George Duke, all these guys are looking at me like, "Wow." And I told Roy, I said, "Man, you know, I just want to go play." He goes, "I think you should." And I quit school the next day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then I just, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what did you do? You came back to Chicago?
Came back to Chicago and then started playing with, you know, different jazz bands, different rock bands, because, you know, I liked both mm-hmm. things. And then I moved out to Elgin, Illinois, where a couple of my friends that I used to play with, like Randy Waldman is this great piano player that plays with everybody. He's like the top session player in L.A. He plays with Barbara Streisand and Kaluta.
Okay.
And then Steve Laspina was the bass player. We had this band. So one day, I think Steve called up and said, "We're going to go out to Elgin. There's this guy, you know, we're just going to go jam with." So I go out, you know, set up my drums in this guy's basement, this guy named Gordon James, who I didn't know. So we start jamming, and Randy's playing like Bye Bye Blackbird, Burning in all 12 keys and everything. And so, you know, and Gordon's kind of just playing really ethereal stuff. So after everybody left, I hung out with Gordon until like 4 in the morning, and we really hit it off. And he goes, "Oh, there's this bass player that's a good friend of mine." So the next day, we jammed again with this guy, Jeff Check. Mm-hmm. And that's how Earwax Control was born.
Oh, yeah?
The band, yeah. And then so I started meeting all these people of like minds. I mean, there were some great musicians out in Elgin. You know, I don't know if,
really?
Yeah, it's amazing.
That would be like the last place
I
would look
for
musicians.
No, I mean, really, a lot of really great musicians, a great scene out there. I mean, it was
what
amazing.
Year was this, roughly?
We're talking about, like, you know, 72, 73.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Wow.
For years, you know.
So that's kind of how it all got started.
Yeah,
you guys were probably playing around town.
Well,
doing different
things. I mean, Chicago was still the big city for us. It was still the nut to crack. So what would happen was that, you know, Jeff or me, Gordon didn't do that much of this, but I mean, we would get a gig in Chicago with somebody, you know, mm-hmm. and then we'd say, "Oh, there's this, yeah, my friend's a really good bass player here," you know, so you
right.
get him on the gig. And then, next, you know, so we start leapfrogging. And the next thing you know, we were playing with everybody in Chicago.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how it happened. I mean, so I never did a card or a demo tape or any of that stuff.
Right.
No.
Well, even back then, I mean, Rush Street was probably happening then.
Yeah, I didn't
and
play that much
or...
on Rush Street. You know, it was more like Lincoln Avenue. The
Okay.
So, you know, Orphans and Colettes and Ratzos and the Wise Fools and, God, you know, all these... I mean, there were so many, the Jazz Bulls, Benchleys, there was all these up and down these streets. You know, it was like a scene. So, you know, you go play, and then on your break, you'd go across the street and hear somebody else. It was just like, you know, like in the bebop years. And then everybody would go out to like this 24-hour Mexican restaurant afterwards, and then we just hang and talk about music all, you know, go to bed at like, you know, 9, 10 in the morning.
Right, because you get to sleep in late.
Yeah, and... you know, I used to get really depressed if I got up before like, you know, 11. I would, because all my friends would be sleeping. Now I want to get up.
You're up.
But back then, yeah, I mean, you know, we would go to bed, or we wouldn't go to bed sometimes, you know.
Right, right. Wow, what a learning experience.
Yeah, well,
too,
yeah,
right?
It was the real thing. I mean, it was really, and then you'd play, and you know, the word would get around. You'd meet new people. I mean, everything. That's how Pat's gig came about. That's how all those gigs came about.
What kinds of music was on Lincoln?
Everything. Well, that's the thing. See, I mean, so I'd play, you know, hard, either like sort of really hardcore jazz with Joe Daly, and then I'd play like ESAM stuff with Ross Trout, and then we'd play some like fusion stuff with some other band, and then we'd go play some funk with some other band. I mean, we'd play some blues.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, so I mean, I look at my book, like in 1978, I was working like 14 gigs a week.
Oh man.
You know, every week. You know, it was amazing. You know,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah. So.
Oh, those days are over.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was kind of your big break, I guess? Was there a big break? It sounds like you were just working all the time anyways. It just kind of naturally progressed? Or...
Well, I mean, really, one of the funniest breaks, this is a funny story. There was, okay, so I'm living in Elgin, right? I'm, you know, basically still trying to break in, so, you know, poor and everything, you know. And there was this band called Street Dancer, which was one of the two big bands in Chicago at that time. So they were coming to play this place called Harry Hope's, which was in Cary. Which, you know, was outside of Chicago. So, I mean, outside of Elgin. So Jeff Check and I, we spent our last $5 to go hear these guys. And when they played, they weren't taking the gig seriously. It was just kind of laughing around and stuff. And so, like, Jeff, halfway through the set, said, I'll go outside, man. You know, you can listen. You know, I'll just wait for you. So they got done playing, and I stood up because the sax player said, you know, we're going to take a break. And I stood up. I said, thank God, because you guys
don't swear
so bad, you know. And then and he looked at me, and then we had these words, right? You know, and I'm
right in front of everybody.
Right in front of everybody. I just stood up. It was like it just because it was like I was so offended by what happened. So then about 6 months later, man, in the morning, I get this call, and it's this low voice, and it's this guy, Santez. And we start talking, and we hit it off like really well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking for about, you know, half hour, 40 minutes. And then finally, you know, he asked me to do this gig. And I said, well, but I have to tell you, man, I'm the guy that, you know, stood up and did this thing, you know. And he goes, yeah, man, you're right. We did, you know. So then through him, all of a sudden, you know, I met like Ross Trout, who was, you know, mm-hmm. Matheny's roommate.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, so all these things sort of leapfrogged off this thing. And, you know, it's weird because, I mean, I take music so serious that I would never normally do something like that. But that's really what sort of got it launched off, you know?
That's unbelievable.
Isn't that funny? I don't usually tell that story. And Santez is a really nice guy. I mean, you know, and the players were really good. It was more that they were out in the sticks, and they were just, you know, just kind of goofing, laughing, and, you know, just not really playing for what the money I paid for
right.
to go here.
Your last
and
$5.
Yeah, it really offended my sensibilities at that time. And, I mean, for all I know, I mean, maybe I had too high of expectations, too. I don't know. But it was just so cool that he goes, yeah, you're right, we did. And then we started playing, you know.
And so that kind of thing just kind of broke the ice and got
well,
you moving
the
on
ice,
the scene.
Yeah, and that, you know, he was – so the next thing I knew, I was playing in the Jazz Bulls, you know, playing with him. And then, you know, other people – the Bulls used to be this club that, you know, you'd play 5-6 sets. You'd play, you know, the last set was at 4 – until 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last set you would think would be a nightmare, but that usually was the best set because that's when all the other musicians would come in, hang, sit in.
Yeah.
It was a scene. So then people would hear you, you know, and that's basically sort of what happened.
Wow. It's so cool to hear that kind of stuff because, you know, I mean, that back then is when music was seriously happening in
oh,
Chicago.
Oh, man, Joe Daly.
I mean,
Joe Daly was a great mentor of mine, you know, and, he, you know, Joe Daly was a sax player that could play anything and has a famous avant-garde record live at Newport, I think from, like, it's like from 63 or something with Hal Russell and Russell Thorne. It was on RCA, but he never got really as famous as he should have gotten because, you know, he had some of his students were like John Clemmer, Joe Farrell, Mike Brecker, Dave Sanborn, mm-hmm. you know. He was just this great teacher. Rich Corpulongo
right,
was like
yep.
one of his prized students. And, man, I saw him like ream people. One time I was playing with him and the piano player was from Milwaukee and he had brought this drummer friend of his, you know, they had driven down to play. So, the last set, he asked Joe, can my friend sit in? And Joe said, yeah, Paul's okay. And I said, yeah, sure, go ahead. So they played Doxy. So it starts, it goes, ba-do, 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 da, da, ba-da, do, do, da, ba-da. And before the head was done, Joe took the song out, turned around at the guy on stage, the drummer said, you ain't cutting it, baby. Looked at me, come on back up here.
Oh, really?
Could you imagine that?
Oh, man.
Could you imagine that ride home for this poor drummer?
Oh, man.
He said, yeah, you ain't making it, baby. That's what he said.
Oh, man.
On the mic.
Yeah.
And, I mean, those were the days. I mean, that's so either you quit or you kill yourself or you get your act together
right.
and come back, you know,
right.
and learn what you did wrong.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I, you know, and just Joe, I mean, guys, and so I'd play with Joe. You know, I was living in Elgin, right? And I'd play, we had Monday nights for years at Orphans. And a lot of times we had great crowds, but sometimes, you know, there'd be a blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And we would come, I'd literally drive in a blizzard.
From Elgin?
To play for like, you know, 7 people maybe the whole night.
Right.
And Joe would pay us out of his own pocket sometimes like 15 bucks or whatever.
Right.
And then I'd drive back. But a lot of times after the show, I would go to Joe's house. And we would listen to like Sonny Rollins or Coltrane and until, you know, sun came up. And here he was like 60. I mean, he's older than I was. I'm now, and here I'm this kid that's 20 years old, and he's got me under his wing. And the other guy that was really good was Barrett Deems. I was like 16 years old, when I was a kid, but just before I could even drive, I would come down and take the train. They had this jam session at Marina Towers at 5 o'clock, and Bear would let me sit in. And, you know, even before I had it together completely, I mean, he was real encouraging See, that's the stuff. That's what a lot of times jazz misses now. I mean, so our school, you try to give that as much of that kind of atmosphere, because we've lived it, so we know what that atmosphere right. is, as opposed to a cold setting, you know, just practice this or whatever. You know, you really have to instill the passion, because that's what jazz is. I mean, if you're going to do this, mm-hmm. it's not just about playing the notes. I mean, you have to communicate something through your instrument to an audience member that might not even know that. They might think your trumpet is a tuba. They don't even know what it is, but you can make that person laugh. You can make them cry.
Yeah.
And that's really what the communication is about. And the people that have done it, I mean, you know, I was in Ireland a couple years ago, and Rufus Reed was one of the other clinicians. And he goes, man, this is my altar. This stage is my altar. Don't come up here and, you know, commit sacrilege on my altar.
Right.
You know, I mean, because that's what it's about. It's really deathly serious. And all the sacrifice that you go through, I mean, it can be a really great life, but, you know, you sacrifice a lot mm-hmm. to do this stuff. And so, you know, then you have kids coming up, or, you know, some young guy that thinks he's all that. And, you know.
Right.
You have to earn it.
Well, since we're talking about that, is there a website at Roosevelt that people can come out and, or people can check out when the ensembles are playing? And...
Yeah, I mean, there's just, you know, just go to, you can just like search like CCPA, you know, on Google or whatever, and they'll take you to the homepage, and then there's calendars. You can go to my website, paulwertico.com. I have all that information, because we have a lot of events that are open to the public that are free. I mean, mm-hmm. Next Tuesday and the following Tuesday will be concerts at the school, and then we have Combo Fest, which I like to call Jazz Fest. I don't like the name Combo for some reason. It's December 6th at Martyrs, Sunday, December 6th from 2 to 6. So all the combos will play. So you really get a chance to hear the different styles. And Martyrs is a great club.
It's a great club.
It's a fantastic thing. But it's people should come out and hear these kids and really support them, because, I mean, they won't be just, it's not like listening to a bunch of students. I mean, it's like going to a free concert and hearing really
right.
kids they're really right. playing. And then, you know, for me, I mean, we have a CD release party at the Evanston Space on Saturday, November 21st. So that's going to be the whole night of just the Mideast Midwest mm-hmm. Alliance playing. And that'll be the next time we've played after the record. We haven't done a gig since then. So that'll be our debut live.
You mean you guys haven't been rehearsing in the basement somewhere?
No. You know, it's funny. I really just didn't want to spoil the first moment we played together.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be what I thought it was going to be, and then be able to document it, as opposed to, you know.
Well, I think it came off great.
Thanks.
You know, being mindful of the time.
Oh, yeah.
I want to make sure that we mention that you've got a instructional DVD. Mm. That was written up in Modern Drummer and also Drum Magazine. And just listen to this, folks. Just the last part of it. Wertico's creative drumming offers a welcome alternative to today's typically dogmatic, technique-laden instructional videos. This is pretty cool.
Well, I mean, I got home yesterday from Ireland, and, you know, Modern Drummer was on, you know, it was on my table, so I opened it up. You know, I'm flipping through, and it said the hit list. It's the drumming videos that set the standard. So it's the best drum videos, according to, you know, to them, of the last 25 years. And to be in,
I mean,
that
you've got
amazing.
Like Steve Gadd, Neil Peart. What's this one?
That's the classic drum ones.
Oh, the classic drums. Yeah.
And then, you know, there's like, you know, Weckl and you know, all
yeah,
the guys.
Everybody's
I mean,
in here.
It's pretty wild.
Steve Smith, Billy Ward, and Paul Wertico.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe it.
So that's on Alfred.
Yeah, it's called Drum Philosophy, and it's basically a reissue of a video that I did for the Japanese for Ritter Music back in the 90s. So it's got my quintet playing in the studio. So it's Lawrence Hobgood, Rich Corpulongo, mm-hmm. Eric Hochberg, and John Mulder. Boy, we all look a lot younger too. And and then there's all these really cool extras. It has Earwax Control playing a wedding, playing.
It's on the video?
Yeah, it's extras. There's a great thing with, Kurt Bly is a great bass player here in town, and he came to hear us back in 86, and he and his fiancée hired us as a wedding band. And we said, we don't play weddings. And he goes, no, just we want you to do what you do. And it's indescribable. No one believes it's real because we're playing this insane stuff at a wedding, and people are digging it. And there's a really interesting thing with this other painter that I did in Poland where they did kind of a – I never met the painter, but I flew in and I started playing some solos. I was going to play with SBB, so we were just setting up. Mm-hmm. And this guy out of the blue said, I want to do a film with you and this other artist. That's on there. The My Modern Drummer Festing is on there from 97. A bunch of cool stuff. Yeah.
So they can check that out on Alfred's. And I want to make sure I mention – paulwertico.com if you want to get all your information and everything. Also, I've got to make sure I get this in. Ray Bailey gave us a call. He's going to be performing at Room 43 from the Hyde Park Jazz Society. This Sunday, it's not only a birthday bash, but it's also a CD release and birthday bash. So it's he's got Harold Buddy Brooks on trumpet, Jimmy Willis on bass, Terry Ross on drums, and Leandro Brady from Argentina on keyboards. So make sure you check that out at the Hyde Park Jazz Society on Sunday nights. Paul, I thank you for dragging yourself in here after traveling all over the world and then being at Roosevelt tonight and everything. This has been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
And I want to make sure that we get to – we're going to hear one tune here. We're going to see how much we can get in before we're out of here. Of course, you're listening to the Mike Jeffers Chicago Jazz Radio Show on Avenue 950 AM. And we'll have this online, as always, on chicagojazz.com tomorrow. But let's hear the final track, at least as much as we can get in, called Good Night and Good Luck. This is on Paul's new CD on Chicago Sessions, Paul Wertico's Mid-East-Midwest Alliance. You can get it on chicagosessions.com. And again, thanks so much for coming in, Paul.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, we'll see you next week from 8 to 10 here on Avenue 950.
Be shaky, but you never turn away. Don't ask me why I'm crying, 'cause when I start to crumble,